Welcome back, everybody, to the Heritage Hub podcast emanating from the Marion County Public Library here on Main Street in Lebanon, Kentucky. I'm James Spraggins, your host, and we have a return guest. His name is Stephen Brady. He's a good friend of mine. The last time we talked about the lagoons, and of Marion County. And Steve Brady, one of the interesting things that I like about him is the things that he is passionate about, and he really knows how to convey that passion, and been an enthusiast and had a lifelong interest, as far as I know, with the life of this area pre-settlement and going way, way, way back. We're talking indigenous peoples, Marion County, and he's been a collector of artifacts, has been kind enough to show some of them to me and others, and he's just got a lot to say. He's a lifelong student, I think, of a lot of things, but also this. And so we'd like to talk to him today about it. Steve has done more. He does more homework. Maybe Gerald Thompson could reach your level of. But I kind of feel like Gerald Thompson, you could pull him in off the street, and he's got a podcast in his head ready to go.
That's right.
And Steve probably does too, but he also takes the time leading up to our scheduled recording to go back and try to put it into a presentable form, and I'm really appreciative of the effort that he takes for these podcasts. And so he's a guy, pretty much anything he wants to talk about, I'd be okay with bringing him in here. We'll talk about it. So Steve, thanks so much for coming. And we're going to talk about indigenous peoples. As long as this area has been settled by Europeans, I suppose, people have noticed things in the land. They have found rocks that have been worked by people we don't know a lot about. We're learning more about them, but we have found mounds, and there's a lot. They left a lot of evidence, is what I'm trying to inelegantly say. And so people have had an interest as long as white people have been here. We've been interested in what they have left us and what we can learn about them through their artifacts and other research. And so. So Steve, thanks so much for being here, and give us an overview of what we're basically talking about today, and what you have learned.
I'll do my best, and I really want to focus on Marion County and Kentucky and the local area, but I decided that we probably should talk about some of the first peoples that came to America before we get into that. Simply because there's so much controversy going on right now with the archaeologists and scholars, you know, who are following it. But
is it like some old assumptions are falling away now as we learn stuff?
The things we thought we knew are all changing every day.
Right.
And it's like a lot of other professions.
Right. Well, could I ask you one quick question, and we'll probably get into it later, but also I was always under the assumption, I'd always heard that Native Americans never lived here all the time. They flowed in. They followed the bison. Nobody was here year round. They came in. They came out. They might have visited some of the same spots when they came through. But do we know more about that now?
We do, and we know for a fact that there were villages all over the state and up and down the waterways, especially in West Kentucky. And there were different tribes that came and went, and would camp for the winter, camp for the summer, and but they built lodges, and they were on these riverbanks up and down the Rolling Fork. Mm-hmm. And some of the larger tribes, we'll get into that in a minute, but some of the larger tribes that coveted Kentucky and held it in such high regard, like the Cherokee and the Iroquois, allowed that. They just didn't want the population to get to be too much, because this was an incredible, Kentucky was an incredible hunting ground back in the day. Mm-hmm. And all you have to do is read a little bit of W.T. Knott's history of Marion County, especially where he taught. W.T. Knott was born in 1822, so he had the benefit of growing up in the 1800s, plus what his father passed on to him. And probably his uncles and other people. W.T. Knott was the older brother of Proctor Knott.
The governor.
The governor. But anyway, he describes, Marion County is a beautiful place. It's a beautiful place today. But just to read his description of it back in the day and how things changed in his lifetime is absolutely incredible. Because he mentions waterways and springs and creeks running year-round that just in his lifetime, because of deforestation and the things that were going on in the 1800s, completely changed the landscape. And a lot of creeks no longer ran year-round. And the river was probably deeper then. So
those trees maintain those shorelines, don't they?
They do. Yeah, they do. And,
trees and cane.
And cane. Yeah. Yeah, there was a lot of cane here.
Right.
Sure was. So anyway, if you're at the library or if you get a chance to get a copy of W.T. Knott's book, you can pick that up here at the library. And it's an excellent read.
I believe the Historical Society some years ago made a nice paperback copy of it. I feel certain it's... I think I'm looking at it right now on the shelves here in the genealogy room. And
yeah.
If you have any interest in the history of this place, boy, it's a great read.
It's wonderful. Yeah. It really is. As I was saying, we are right now, today as we speak, going through a fundamental shift in scientific thinking about how people, the first people, arrived in the Americas. We have long thought that the Clovis people were the first humans to cross the Bering Strait. Finding out that's not the case, but we thought that they crossed the Bering Strait, Beringia, the Beringia land bridge between Alaska and Siberia about 13,000 years ago. And we refer to this, and scholars refer to this as the Clovis first theory. They were megafauna hunters, meaning they hunted mammoths and large game, ground sloths, huge bison. They were much bigger than the buffalo we have today.
Oh, wow.
And they developed unique flint projectile points specifically designed for hunting big game. And you can do some research on this, but they're called bifacial points, and they're shaped like a long, narrow leaf with a concave base. Oftentimes, they will be anywhere from 4 inches long, 3 or 4 inches long, till about 8 inches long, some of them 9 and 10. The base was usually fluted on both sides for a secure attachment to their spear or atlatl dart, as they were often referred to. And atlatl is spelled A-T-L-A-T-L, if you want to research that. But the atlatl is an ancient tool used for additional leverage in throwing a spear. Most were about 2 to 3 feet in length, and they are still used today by the Aborigines in Australia. Hmm. The introduction of the atlatl into Europe some 30,000 years ago was a quantum leap in technology for early hunter-gatherer peoples. It allowed hunters to stay at a safe distance from dangerous animals and provided more leverage, velocity, impact, and impact when thrown. Getting back to the Clovis culture, it was thought that once the glaciers started to melt at the end of the last ice age and created an ice-free corridor into North America, that those people gradually migrated into North and South America. The first Clovis points were found in 1929 in Blackwater Draw near Clovis, New Mexico, by a fellow by the name of James Whitman. He was an amateur archaeologist, and he immediately recognized their significance as they were interspersed with mammoth bones. Over time, Clovis points were found all over the United States, especially in the eastern United States, including Kentucky and Marion County. They are rare, as most of them have descended into the ground over so many millennia. Scientists and archaeologists embraced the Clovis theory until the 1970s, when radiocarbon dating came into widespread use. Some indigenous excavation sites that dated back to the 1950s and 1960s could now be more accurately dated. By the 1990s, the idea of the Clovis First Peoples was hotly contested. It's still being debated and analyzed today. It's becoming very clear that the history of the First Peoples of America, of North America, is being redefined and rewritten every year. One thing is clear. Humans have been in North America much longer than we realized. I've been following some of the excavation sites for years and will share with you some of the notes of interest, which you can do further research on if you wish. Before getting into the line item dates, I wanted to share with you an interesting story that was published in 2017 by the Smithsonian Magazine and other news outlets reporting an ongoing lawsuit between the British Columbia government and the Heiltsik Indian tribe. Heiltsik is spelled H-E-I-L-T-S-U-K, regarding the ownership of Trickett Island off the coast of B.C. The government contended that the island was not part of their ancestral homelands or had anything to do with previous agreements. The Heiltsik people insisted that it was their land and they had occupied it since the last ice age and stayed on the island during the ice age as it did not freeze over for some reason. The government said this was preposterous, and there were many reasons that that was false and no way the Heiltsik could prove it. The Heiltsik claimed their ancestors had passed down this information orally and it was accurate. The courts then ordered an archaeological dig on some of the oldest village sites that the Heiltsik people pointed out to them. In the end, the tribe was able to prove that they had occupied Trickett Island for 14,000 years. Trickett Island, and that's spelled T-R-I-Q-U-E-T, is 250 miles above Vancouver, Washington, but about 1,000 miles south of the most southeast corner of the Alaskan border. So they were close to Washington State. And this led to the next quandary. How did they get there? Because this was before the ice-free corridor was open. And that has now led archaeologists to start considering that coastal migrations was indeed possible.
Would this be too far for a watercraft to get them there, or from the mainland? Or I haven't looked at this on the map, but
actually, there. If you look at that on a map, and of course, during the Ice Age that would be complicated, and you would have to live off of the, off the ice shelf and out of the sea to make that trek.
I see.
But from Siberia, it's a short distance from Siberia through across the Bering Strait, actually, and you might even be able to see that across there. But once it was frozen over, it became a roadway. But there's also a string of islands shaped like a bow underneath the Bering Strait, and somebody who was opportunistic enough and skilled enough to go from island to island could actually make that crossing over to the United States. Mm-hmm. with a little bit of skill. And that's something else we're finding out now, too, is that people were a lot more skilled than we realize, as far as...
And inventive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very much so. Other dates and other sites and dates in North and South America that we know about right now with solid carbon dates are the Paisley Caves up in Oregon. And we know that they're 14 to 15,000 years old, meaning that human occupation has been there that long. Cactus Hill in Virginia, 16 to 20,000 years. Meadowcroft Rock Shelter in Pennsylvania is a very interesting site. And we know that it's 19,000 years old, but they think that they're going to be able to take that maybe on up to 22 to 25,000 years old before very long. It was continually inhabited for centuries, for millennia.
I assume this is a pretty big rock shelter. Having hiked around, like we were just talking before we recorded, Red River Gorge, there's a lot of rock shelters in there, and
yeah,
they always say, there might have been huts under here, or, it was a natural place to take refuge from the elements, but none of them are huge.
Yeah.
This must have been, I assume this is...
It's a big one.
It's a big one, yeah.
The Topper site in South Carolina and Savannah is 16 to 20,000 years old. White Sands National Park, New Mexico is 21 to 23,000 years old. And I think somewhere in that area, they've just found these footprints. I read something about that a few weeks ago that may be 25,000 years old or older. Monte Verde is in Chile, and they've got solid dates on that of 18,500 years ago, but there's a fellow by the name of Professor Tom Dillahay that's been excavating there for years and years, and he thinks that they're going to be able to date that at a much, much older date. The last place I've got here is Petra Fiureta in Brazil. It's a collection of rock shelters. And they're showing dates on that of 32 to 44,000 years, but I'm going to have to do some more research on that to see how they're coming up with that.
That's really interesting, because the farther south they're going, they entered from the Bering Strait, presumably. The farther we're able to date them much older, the farther south they went.
That's right. So you can see why the Clovis First theory is now in doubt. There were indeed humans here long before Clovis people. Clovis people are correctly dated, and they probably did cross the Beringia Strait ice-free corridor over 13,000 years ago. They did not stay in one place very long, and they moved across North and South America very quickly. At some point around 9,000 BC, the Clovis culture vanished altogether. At the same time, all of the megafauna vanished. We have previously in the last podcast mentioned the Younger Dryas period that started 12,900 years ago and ended 11,700 years ago. Whatever happened during this time period basically wiped out the Clovis people and the megafauna in North America. So time passes, and people gradually return to North America in the thousands of years that follow the Younger Dryas period. The climate becomes more hospitable again, and human populations flourish. In our area, one of the first large cultures was the Archaic Adena culture. It's one of the first permanent cultures in our Kentucky area. And as I said, they're referred to as the Adena. The culture dates back to around 800 BC and starts to end around 200 AD. They were based in Chillicothe, Ohio, and spread into northern Kentucky, West Virginia, and eastern Indiana and extreme West Pennsylvania. They were among the first tribes to practice mound building in their ceremonial rituals and burials. Many of them are still standing. They were hunter-gatherers, but did cultivate pumpkins, squash, sunflowers, and goosefoot.
What is goosefoot? I saw that in your notes.
Goosefoot is grown in your backyard.
Okay.
It's all over this county. It's also referred to, the botanical name is Chenopodium. You can look that up, Chenopodium.
Okay.
C-H-E-N-O-P-O-D, you know, Chenopodium.
Okay.
It has a seed pod on it. And the Indians would collect that, and I'll get into that in a minute, what they did with some of those seeds and nuts and berries, but they had all sorts of applications for that, you know, for those foods. They were widespread traders, and they possessed marine conch shells, which came from the East Coast or Florida, so obviously they were trading all up and down the coast. They also had copper tools, bracelets, rings and pendants that they sourced from the Great Lakes region. And the reason why they sourced that from the Great Lakes region is it's the only place in the United States where you can find raw copper. So that's how that came to be a popular site, you know, in the north, and a big trade item among the indigenous people. They were highly skilled in flint and tool making, and these people continued to use the atlatl spear thrower, just like the Clovis people had in earlier times.
That's interesting. You say that the mound building, that's relatively recent compared to some of these older peoples that were coming across the Bering Strait. That's That's relatively recent. You're saying to 800 BC to
right.
AD.
Right.
That's interesting. So that the notion that you needed to prepare the body for the next life, which I think we'll probably get into in a little bit, that's interesting. Maybe that was a more recent concept or something to them. I don't know.
I think mound building was, it's just like, I think believing in a higher power with human beings. I think it was hardwired into their DNA. Mm-hmm. The Vikings did it. They did it all over the planet.
Wow. Yeah.
It's just in America they did some pretty substantial building. And my God, Tenochtitlan in Mexico, which is now Mexico City, it would be, I don't know if you could calculate how much dirt that those people moved to make that city. Hmm. It must have taken 1,000 years, forever. The second period that we're going to get into is the Middle Woodland period, which is referred to as the Hopewell culture. And this time period was from 100 BC until 500 AD. The name Hopewell was given by Warren K. Moorhead after his mound excavations in Ross County, Ohio, in 1891 and 1892. A fellow by the name of Mordecai Hopewell owned the family farm they stood on. The Hopewell culture overlapped the Edina culture, but was much more spread out as far north as New York and West Illinois, Missouri, and Iowa, and parts of Nebraska and Oklahoma. And I just mentioned Edina, and that name, by the way, came from a homestead. I can't remember the people that owned that place, but they had named their home. It was a businessman where those Edina mounds were first excavated, and that's how that got the name Edina. These people were still using the Atlatl for hunting, and although the bow and arrow would be coming into wider use at the end of their culture period. And they were also outstanding craftsmen, and they were trading nationwide. They were elaborate mound builders, and their octagon earthwork in Newark, Ohio, is regarded as a lunar observatory. You can research this further, but it is a complicated mathematical structure built on precise straight and parallel lines, and it is worth looking into that. It's an incredible structure that they built there, and clearly was some type of observatory.
How far up north in Ohio is that? How close to Kentucky?
That was Newark, Ohio. I think that is that would be northeast of Cincinnati.
Okay.
The Hopewell created some of the finest crafts and artwork in the Americas. Some of their animal effigy pipes are so precise that they look like a real small version of the animal they recreated. Many of their artistic skills were shared with other tribes who in turn traded with other regional tribes. After 500 AD, the Hopewell went into decline, and most scholars think it was because of war breaking out. The next period we're going to move into is the Late Woodland period, and this is the Mississippian culture, who are known as the Mound Builders. And their time period is between 800 AD and 1600 AD. So they were still here, obviously, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but they were still here when the Spanish came. Sometimes I wonder if the Hopewell culture really went into decline or if many of the chiefdoms just packed up and spread out. There was obviously a population explosion during that time period. The introduction of corn from Mexico during this period may have been a factor. These people were growing corn, beans, and squash, and goosefoot and maygrass that we mentioned before. But the corn, beans, and squash are also known as the Three Sisters. I guess they got that name because the Indians had a specific way that they would plant corn, and it would be on small mounds about 30 inches apart. And then later they would plant a short time later, they would plant squash and beans. And the beans would provide nitrogen for the soil, which corn needs nitrogen. And then the squash leaves are big leaves, and they would provide cover for the ground to keep moisture in the ground as the corn grew. So
yeah, big leaves, they really shade the ground.
They were pretty smart about, you know, and figured out how to do that.
Right.
At harvest time, the corn would be dried and the remaining squash as well, and all stored in underground cellars. These cellars were shaped like giant old-fashioned milk jugs underground. And beans were also stored in the cellars in their homes. Up until this time period, most homes had been circular or longhouses with bark coverings. But during this period of the Mississippian culture, most homes were square with a thatched roof, similar to a small house or cabin today. The Middle Mississippian capital was in Cuyahoga, Illinois. They are called Mississippian because their culture began in the Mississippi Valley. The present-day park sits on 2,200 acres and has about 80 mounds. The original city covered 6 square miles and 120 earthen mounds. Monk's Mound is the largest structure on the site, standing 10 stories high, less the huge building that once stood on top of it. The base of the mound is roughly the same size as the Pyramid of Giza in Egypt. The reason why it's called Monk's Mound also is because the early missionaries used that as their campground and to stay at that location while they did their missionary work.
Interesting. Okay.
The Mississippian Empire was extensive, covering the entire southeast all the way to Florida and all the way down the Mississippi River. Another group of Mississippians called the Caddoan Mississippians covered Kansas, Oklahoma, and parts of Nebraska. The Oneota Mississippian, going up the Missouri River and reaching into Minnesota and Wisconsin, was another large group. The Falls of the Ohio and most of central Kentucky, including Marion County, were within the borders of the central capital of Cuyahoga and Cuyahoga control. Many burial mounds were here in Marion County prior to 1800. And W.T. Knott talks about this, and also Mr. Johnson.
Johnson, yeah. They wrote Lebanon as I've known it.
He wrote about the mounds.
That's another great historical account that thoroughly enjoyed reading.
Very similar to the Hopewell, the Mississippians were excellent craftsmen as well. They developed high-quality, shell-tempered pottery, and many of their arrowheads found in this area are smaller by comparison, and they're triangular-shaped. They were also excellent craftsmen of natural copper from the Great Lakes. They, too, traded nationwide with Mexico. They also developed a fairly complex chiefdom level of social complexity. These people typically used the bow and arrow for hunting. Their population in the Middle Mississippian area of the Cuyahoga capital, that's just the capital area, is estimated to have been 30,000 to 40,000 people by 1500. So you would have to imagine that their entire territory probably included several hundreds of thousands of people. The last culture we're going to speak about is the Fort Ancient culture.
Can I stop you just for a second?
Yeah.
The people that we just talked about, the Mississippian culture mound builders. So that, looking at that, these are the people Daniel Boone would not have known. He did not run into these people. These people were, their culture timeline ended a little bit before he got, somebody like him got to Kentucky. They might have known the Spanish. I'm sure knew the Spanish. But they didn't know the folks who settled here coming across the Cumberland Gap. Is that right?
Daniel Boone didn't.
Yeah.
Some of the Spanish did. Yeah. And I'll talk about that in just a minute. But what we're all going to discover here is that as soon as the Spanish came, and started interacting with the Native Americans, the disease took them out. Mm-hmm. And it's hard telling how many.
They had no immunity for the disease, the European diseases.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Probably, I would say it was in the millions.
Right, right.
The Fort Ancient culture had multiple villages in southern Ohio and northern Kentucky. And they are also a sister culture to the Mississippians. There's evidence to suggest that they were not descendants of the Hopewell people, even though they were on the same ground that the Hopewell had occupied previously. They were likely the builders of the Great Serpent Effigy Mound in Pebbles, Ohio. They lived in multiple villages, with some in Bourbon County, Kentucky, in the Bourbon County, Kentucky area. The majority over time were north of the Ohio, in Ohio and Indiana. The main Fort Ancient village was probably built around 2,000 years ago by the Hopewell people. It's 245 feet above the Miami River, and it's surrounded by 18,000 feet of earthworks or wall. It was not a defensive wall, as there are entry gaps all the way around. Archaeologists have calculated the earthworks to contain 553,000 cubic yards of dirt and would have taken over 300 years to build. And they also feel like that more than anything else, that earthworks was a religious site. There's probably things that were there that's not there now, but it was probably a religious site.
Hmm.
These people hunted in Kentucky with the bow and arrow and made small triangular arrowheads similar to the Mississippians. Excavations of sites show that they had numerous European trade goods in later times, but there's no evidence whatsoever that they had contact with the settlers or traders. In other words, they must have obtained these items from other tribes who were trading with the settlers. The population disappeared in waves, and it is thought European diseases ended their culture. Hernando de Soto, the Spanish explorer, met with and spent time with many of the southern Mississippian villages in 1541. In a very short period of time, measles, smallpox, and cholera, and other diseases ravaged village after village of these people. The Native Americans had no immunity to those diseases. It will never be known how many of them perished. Prior to Europeans, it is estimated the population of Native Americans was 100 million nationwide. And I think that includes Mexico, the Aztecs in Mexico. Kentucky was a unique territory among all cultures in the region for the last 3,000 or 4,000 years. I've heard it called the Happy Hunting Ground, the Middle Ground, the Dark and Bloody Ground. But who knows what the Indians really called it. And maybe John Filson could shed some light on that. One thing is for certain, it was held in high regard. The Iroquois Confederacy in the Northeast laid claim to Kentucky as well as the Cherokee. The Chickasaw lived in West Kentucky, but their numbers were so low, the powerful tribes tolerated it. I think they also tolerated many other small settlements up and down the rivers, and many tribes had hunting agreements that were accepted as well. The Shawnee were a powerful tribe in Chillicothe, Ohio, and little by little, they kept encroaching into northern Kentucky, and their migration in their villages got so large that the Iroquois finally said, you know, something's got to be done. So the Iroquois came down and drove them back into Ohio in 1670. The Shawnee were powerful warriors, but they thought twice about taking on the Confederacy. The Confederacy was a large, powerful league of nations made up of the Seneca, the Cayuga, the Onondaga, the Oneida, the Mohawk, and the Tuscarora, stretching from Lake Erie to New York. An interesting note in that democracy is that the women made decisions on leadership, land, and resources. You might also find it interesting how their form of government was implemented into our Constitution and Bill of Rights by our founding fathers. No such democracies existed in Europe for John Adams and Jefferson and Ben Franklin to study at the time. The Confederacy owes its creation to the great peacemaker and his student chief, Hiawatha. The Iroquois claim the prophet, the peacemaker, showed up 2,000 years ago and convinced the tribes their future would be better served if they were united. It is thought that he was of Huron descent. Scholars date this creation to 1142 A.D., when Hiawatha was pleading with the last holdout tribe, the Onondaga, to join the Confederacy, the Iroquois Confederacy. A solar eclipse occurred just as Hiawatha finished speaking, and the Onondaga chief agreed to join.
Don't blame him.
Getting back to Kentucky, all of the cities and towns and villages after 1000 A.D. had become hunter-gatherer farmers. They were able to have more permanent settlements. Crops at this time were corn, squash, beans, sunflowers, and tobacco, goosefoot, and maygrass. Game was plentiful, and Native Americans were masters at collecting fish and wildlife. The Rolling Fork River would have been full of fish wares in those days. And if you want to look that up, that's spelled W-E-I-R-S, fish wares.
Is that a sort of a trap?
They're huge, elaborate traps made all across the river or halfway across the river to catch fish or channel fish into a holding pen or whatever. They also made fish traps, but those fish wares are usually placed in strategic locations like below riffles. And fish could not only be channeled into a containment holding areas, but they could be kept alive indefinitely for a later use. The natives were very good at weaving material and made large seines to use in the waterways as well. The Rolling Fork was teeming with wildlife in and around the waterway, and native people up and down the river consumed freshwater mussels on a regular basis.
You still see mussel shells.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
There's a shell mound over in Indiana it would be hard to say how many tons of shells.
Is that right?
It's called the shell mound.
Meaning where they discarded the shells.
Where they discarded the shells.
Right.
But it's an entire mound.
Yeah. Huh.
Right on the Ohio Riverbank.
Mm-hmm. Were they using the shells for anything? I know a lot of people, you know, used to be buttons were made from shell.
They made a lot of things with the shells. They made a lot of things with them, and they made ornaments and shells to go around their neck.
Yeah.
They also made with the big clam shells. They would make hoes out of them to hoe their gardens with.
Oh, right.
And speaking of that, they would also use the shoulder blade of a deer as a hoe. And they made flint hoes.
Yeah.
So they had, you know, a variety of different, you know, hoes that they could make to, you know, tend their fields with. Nut trees were abundant in Kentucky, and the people also collected and stored acorns and nuts by the bushels. Some acorns can be eaten as is, but most of them require soaking or boiling to remove the tannins in them, and then they can be eaten safely and used. Dried nuts and berries and dried meats were often used to make a food called pemmican. That's like a large granola bar that they would form with dried meat and those berries and nuts, and then render it with fat, or mix the fat in it, and let them harden into bars. And those things would have a shelf life of years. You can make those on your kitchen stove in the house.
My boys did that as a school project when they were studying with Jan Lanham. She had them make it, because as soon as I ran across that word, it's like, oh, I know about these.
Yeah.
It would give you lots of energy, you know, I would assume. Yeah.
High protein.
Right.
There's another significant feature and resource about Kentucky that is only just now coming into focus. It's the Barrens of Kentucky. It is a 200-mile long by 35-mile wide stretch of grassland. It was probably larger in ancient times. Early settlers noted that the Cherokee would set fire to it late every fall and create an immense inferno. But when spring came, it would blossom into the beautiful expanse of unto a beautiful expanse of nut bushes, berries, and grasses. The barrens were bordered by several rivers, the Cumberland River on the south, and waterways and numerous salt licks that many animals sought out. All sorts of wildlife were abundant in the barrens. From what we understand today, the practice of burning had been going on for centuries. Elk, deer, bear, bison, and hundreds of other species would migrate to the area in the following spring and summer.
And the game fowl. I would assume that's the perfect land for pheasant, quail, things like that.
Perfect. So it sounds like the Cherokee created and maintained one of the largest game preserves in North America centuries ago. And that's also helping us understand why Kentucky was, you know, another reason why Kentucky was so coveted. In 1722, the Iroquois Confederacy came back to Kentucky in numbers to survey their claims in Kentucky, and they pushed the Cherokee back to the Smoky Mountains. They took control of all the land north of the Cumberland River. It remained in Iroquois control until the onset of the French and Indian War, 1750 to 1754. After several council meetings later on, the Confederacy granted permission for the Cherokee to return back to the lands north of the Cumberland River, including the barrens. It is unknown how the barrens came to be. Maybe it started with a lightning strike that burned thousands of acres. Whatever happened, the Cherokee knew how to manage it in the centuries to follow. Cherokee were an interesting tribe who were secluded in the Appalachian Mountains for centuries. A lot of the other Indian tribes, by the way, referred to them as the cave people, or people who come out of the ground. The Cherokee referred to themselves as the principal people. But I guess because they lived in those mountains, that's how they got, and I'm sure they lived under rock shelters too, and maybe they did live in caves, but other tribes called them the cave people. They were above average, and soon after contact with first settlers, Chief Sequoia quickly realized the significance of written language and proceeded to create their own alphabet, which allowed most of the Cherokee to become literate in less than 15 years. That's a true story. Fort Campbell sits on 100,000 acres in the barrens in southern Kentucky and northern Tennessee, and conservationists and the city and the Corps of Engineers are trying to preserve 7,400 acres of the original landscape. In a final settlement of their lands in 1791 with the USA, the Cherokee were recognized as the owners of the land we call Kentucky. Kentucky and adjacent lands were ceded to the U.S. at that time. 47 years later, most of the Cherokee were on their way to Oklahoma and would never see Kentucky or their homes again. I'm very thankful to the United States government, Fort Campbell, and conservationists in Kentucky and Tennessee, and the Cherokee who were involved, for trying to preserve the grasslands and the barrens of today.
You talk about them being the Cherokee being the, they were called the cave people. Well, Kentucky doesn't lack for caves, so this, you know, they quickly understood the importance of...
We have caves.
We have caves. That is true. That's exactly right.